Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Andrew Kroll, a reporter with Mother Jones Magazine, who assesses the labor movement's response to the corporate-backed conservative political and economic attack on unions and the middle class. Michael Jacobson, executive director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, who talks about the efforts now underway in the Republican-controlled House to cut federal funding for food, health, and safety regulations. And Dr. Deborah Richter of Vermont for Single Payer, who talks about her group's campaign to establish a universal health care system in her state, resulting in a single-payer bill recently passed by the Vermont House of Representatives. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Political violence in the West African nation of Ivory Coast has driven over a million people from their homes and drawn the country to the brink of civil war. The months-long crisis was caused by the refusal of President Laurent Gbagbo to hand over power after he lost last November's election to the declared winner, Alassane Ouattara, who is recognized by the African Union, European Union, and the United States. Ivory Coast is the world's biggest producer of cocoa. After a March 24th African Union deadline passed for Gbagbo to step down, troops loyal to Ouattara stormed out of the north, the main cocoa-producing region, and quickly surrounded forces loyal to Gbagbo, who kept control of the presidential palace in the capital city of Abidjan and the state-run television network. Many of Abidjan's citizens fled, creating a humanitarian crisis in neighboring countries like Liberia. In the midst of the upheaval, French troops took control of Ivory Coast's main airport, while troops loyal to Ouattara surrounded Abidjan. French troops and United Nations peacekeepers attacked several of Gbagbo's military bases and destroyed weapons stockpiles. 12,000 UN peacekeepers are in Ivory Coast with the mission of using all necessary force to protect civilians under the imminent threat of violence. Since the disputed election, won by Ouattara, more than 12,000 people have been killed in politically related violence. With the price of gasoline approaching $4 a gallon, car buyers are eyeing new energy-efficient American-made automobiles. While car buyers are interested in four-cylinder vehicles like the Ford Focus, there is little interest in new all-electric vehicles like the Chevy Volt and Nissan Leaf. According to the Christian Science Monitor, General Motors only sold 600 Volts in March, a good month for American automakers. Most car buyers see the new electric cars as novelty vehicles and not a realistic option for consumers pressed by rising gasoline prices. In March, GM saw an 11% jump in car and truck sales, driven by its new energy-efficient sedan, the Cruise Echo, which gets over 40 miles a gallon on the highway. Ford saw its sales soar in new energy-efficient cars such as the Fiesta, Focus, and Escape. In a few short months, American carmakers with new vehicles that get better than 40 miles per gallon have caught up with Japanese automakers like Toyota that have long dominated the market for energy-efficient cars. Toyota's best-selling hybrid, the Prius, the leader in fuel economy for non-electric vehicles, remains extremely popular. Toyota sold over 18,000 Prius cars in March, a 50% increase from a year earlier. On the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire that killed 146 garment workers in New York City's Greenwich Village, labor activists launched a new campaign to protect immigrant workers in New York's low-wage restaurants. The anti-sweatshop group Justice Will Be Served rallied activists in front of the Saigon Grill, a Vietnamese restaurant with a long list of labor violations. In 2008, a federal judge ordered the former owners of the Manhattan Eatery to pay $4.6 million in back wages and damages to Chinese immigrant delivery workers who often worked over 70 hours a week. According to the news magazine In These Times, food service workers are among the lowest paid workers in the country. A typical restaurant worker in New York City earns $24,000 a year. The Saigon Grill reopened last October with new owners, but controversy has continued to dog the restaurant. Workers now accuse current management of age discrimination and firing workers who sought to form a union. Recently, most of the workers at Saigon Grill voted to join Local 713 of the International Brotherhood of Trade Unions, a local that some organizers accuse of being backed by Saigon Grill's owners. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
After weeks of enormous demonstrations in Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, as well as other states, people from all walks of life challenged Republican governors attempting to weaken workers' rights. Union activists protested across the country on April 4th in what they called We Are One rallies. Over 1,000 protests, teach-ins, and other events marked the day 43 years ago when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. The civil rights leader was in Memphis to support the city's unionized sanitation workers who were on strike for fair wages and treatment. The coordinated assault by conservative governors on public employees' right to collective bargaining has resulted in a nationwide backlash. Recent public opinion polls have found that a large majority of Americans oppose the GOP campaign to scapegoat teachers, firefighters, policemen, and other middle-class workers for large state deficits produced by the nation's economic meltdown, triggered by Wall Street's unethical speculation. The labor movement and their allies are fighting back on a number of fronts, including the collection of signatures for recall campaigns targeting 8 Wisconsin Republican senators who backed Governor Scott Walker's anti-union bill, and a statewide referendum in Ohio to reject legislation gutting workers' rights initiated by Governor John Kasich. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Andrew Kroll, a reporter in the D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones magazine, who discusses labor's response to the corporate-backed conservative political and economic attack on unions and the middle class, explored in his recent article titled, Return to Wisconsin, the Beginning or the End?
Over the 2+ weeks I spent in Madison, this was in the end of February and getting into the very beginning of March, you know, I saw an outpouring of support, people young and old, of all races, all ethnicities, getting out in the street and mobilizing and getting angry and writing snarky signs and banging on drums and writing, you know, posting banners inside this beautiful rotunda at the Wisconsin State Capitol. And it was amazing. It was inspiring in the literal sense of the word, not the cliched use of inspiring that people often use, but it was a sight to behold. The broader takeaway, you know, as I write in this story, is still unclear, but I came away optimistic for a lot of reasons. Obviously, if Republican Governor Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, if his anti-union bill passes, it will be a major blow to labor unions in his state. We've seen these kinds of bills or these kinds of measures enacted in other states, most notably in Indiana. And the result has been a serious kneecapping of unions' power in these states to bargain, to keep up their membership, to really have a voice at the bargaining table, if they're going to the bargaining table at all. Now, Walker's bill is still in legal limbo. Now, it remains to be seen whether it is going to become law soon or later this year or at all. We saw so many people coming together in Madison, not just tried and true organizers who have been in the trenches before, but students, both at the college level and at the high school level, and older retirees, and people at the end of their working careers, coming together and mobilizing like never before, not in their lifetimes, and not in their communities like this. You know, I tell the story of one 22-year-old guy named Tom Bird in my story, a nuclear engineering master's student, total whiz kid, scrawny geek, who was radicalized by these events. And within the span of weeks became this diehard labor organizer, you know, a real compassionate guy, you know, hard on his sleeve, who just doesn't think what the governor's doing is right. wasn't that political, wasn't that active before, and now he's starting his own organizations, he's organizing rallies, he's bringing in speakers like John Nichols, like the top Democrats in the Wisconsin legislature. So seeing Tom and seeing other people, the other Toms in the crowd, that was inspiring. And that ultimately gave me more hope than the despair I saw in the possibility of unions in that state being knocked down, because, you know, it, maybe if unions lose their clout and there's this vacuum here, maybe people like Tom and others will fill that gap with some new kind of organizing power, some new kind of organization or force.
Andy, there's a certain partisan political dimension and motivation to what some of these Republican governors are doing to eviscerate public sector unions in their states. Talk a little bit about what you see in terms of the end game here, how some of these Republican governors really want to defund the Democratic Party, of which the unions are a prime base of support, door knocking, but also money contributions.
Any Republican lawmaker who, during these debates on these anti-union bills throughout the country, says that there's no political element to these efforts is lying. I think when they're speaking candidly or caught off guard, these Republicans in Wisconsin and elsewhere have admitted so much that there are serious political consequences to knocking out public sector unions who are, as you said, a pillar of support for the Democratic Party, not only in get-out-the-vote efforts, in knocking on doors, but in fundraising. You know, AFSCME, which is one of the biggest, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, is one of the biggest players in campaign finance and money in politics today. They're a huge supporter of the Democratic Party, and especially at the state level, this is true. So what we're seeing in all these, you know, more than 20 states around the country, it's not just an effort to undercut unions, but an effort to, as you said, defund the Democratic Party very much at the state level. If you knock out public sector unions at the state level, you are almost dealing a death blow to those Democratic parties.
It seems clear that labor unions' tactics over recent decades have not worked to draw more people to the union movement, and they've lost great numbers of membership over recent years. Do you see what's happening across the country in these battles over public sector unions as a trigger to wake labor unions out of maybe the same old thing they've been doing for many years and sort of spark some new thinking there?
In the near term, this fight, I think, will be good for labor unions. I don't think that this fight is the kind of event that galvanizes labor unions to the point where they can reverse decades-long trends. The forces at play for why this membership has declined can't be countered by what we're seeing now, even though unions are fighting for their lives. I'm talking about globalization. I'm talking about the Democratic Party's, at least at the national level, their decision over, and this has been going on for 30 years, to move more toward corporate America than to embrace their union roots. And it also ties into, you know, where the money is coming from to fund our elections. You know, in the aftermath of the Citizens United decision, corporations have an ever more powerful role in deciding who wins and who loses. And both Democrats and Republicans will be looking to corporations and not necessarily looking to labor unions as much. And that hurts the unions and their clout. I don't think we're going to see unions completely wiped off the map. I think with their backs to the wall, they're going to fight like all get out. And maybe we could see a small resurgence in the near term, but it's going to take something far larger than this fight. It's going to have to take major global economic changes to bring unions back to the point where we saw them, say, in the 60s or 70s.
That was Andrew Kroll, a reporter in the D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones Magazine and associate editor with TomDispatch.com. For a link to Kroll's recent articles on the labor struggle, visit our website at btlonline.org. The Food and Drug Administration just released proposed rules requiring chain restaurants and other establishments that primarily serve food to display calorie counts of the food they sell. The requirement was part of the health care reform legislation passed by Congress just over a year ago. According to the National Institutes of Health, more than a third of adults and nearly 17% of children in the United States are obese, increasing their chances of developing health problems, including type 2 diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, fatty liver disease, and some cancers. Obesity-related diseases account for nearly 10% of U.S. medical spending, or an estimated $147 billion a year. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Michael Jacobson, executive director and co-founder in 1971 of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. One of the group's signature issues is nutrition, along with food safety. The organization gained notoriety in 1994 when it released data on the high amount of saturated fat in movie house popcorn. An earlier version of the FDA labeling rules included food served in theaters, but after intense lobbying by the industry, they were exempted from the calorie posting requirements. Jacobson discusses his group's priorities and his concerns about the Republican-controlled House effort to cut federal funding for health and safety regulations.
We have tremendous concerns in some of the areas, like Tea Partiers would love to repeal the health reform legislation, which provides about $1 billion a year for the first time to support prevention campaigns, preventing health problems. And so the initial money is funding wonderful state and local programs to improve diets, promote exercise, reduce smoking. So that's a constant target of Republicans. In terms of food safety, the Republicans want to cut the FDA's budget rather than increase it. And that will only increase foodborne illness outbreaks in this country, which would mean fewer inspectors, inability to respond to outbreaks. And we'll have more and more cases, if the Republicans get their way, of people getting sick from or dying from salmonella, E. coli, and other foodborne pathogens.
Where does the FDA budget stand now? Do you feel like it's drastically underfunded?
Yeah, it's considerably underfunded. But in the last few years, Congress has provided a fair amount more money, but much of that money would disappear.
And is that money for increased on-the-ground inspections?
Yeah, on the ground in the United States and abroad, because China likes to occasionally send us tainted food.
Is there any other specific area you're concerned about with this new Congress?
In discussing the agriculture budget includes not just farm subsidies, but food stamps and the Food and Drug Administration. And a couple of key Congress people have said, we have to cut the agriculture budget. And let's start with food stamps, not farm subsidies. And that's just crazy. Many legislators and administrations recognize the stupidity of some of these farm subsidies that go to huge farms and end up raising, in some cases, raising prices to consumers. You know, keeping out imported sugar costs consumers several $1 billion a year in higher food prices. Giving millions of dollars to certain huge farms is unconscionable. And Senator Harkin and others have wanted to reduce these subsidies or limit subsidies to $250,000 or some other figure. And Congress is likelier, and that would save considerable money each year, but Congress seems like they might cut food stamp budgets instead, take it out of the poor. We have high unemployment and people with poor educations. It makes life tough for a lot of people. Food stamps is a wonderful safety net and something that should not be cut.
Michael Jacobson, do you have any evidence that movie house popcorn has gotten any less bad since you did that expose so many years ago that made Center for Science and the Public Interest famous?
I can't remember which theaters switched to canola oil. There's been some improvement, but some theaters still use coconut oil. But regardless of the oil, these huge containers of popcorn contain 1,000 calories. They're just so out of proportion to common sense servings. Movie theater popcorn is still a problem. The theater industry is trying to prevent the Food and Drug Administration from requiring calorie disclosures on the kind of menu boards at movie theaters. And the FDA is going to be coming out with a Federal Register proposal on menu labeling. And one of the issues will be, should theaters be covered or not?
Is it by state or are there federal regulations now? Like when you go into a McDonald's anywhere, they have to post that?
California, New York City, Philadelphia, a few other locations. The law was passed, but it hasn't been implemented. Hopefully the regulations would take effect sometime next year.
So when the regulations go into effect, people patronizing chain restaurants, at least, will be able to see what they're buying. So you actually think that's an important step, that that can change people's behavior?
That's right. It'll change some people's behavior, but it's not going to be like flipping that light switch. It'll give people information. They have to see it, and they have to use it. And a lot of it's up to them. I think a lot of people go into, they don't even look at a menu or menu board. When they go to McDonald's, they know what they're going to have because they've ordered it for the last 10 years. So those people probably won't be affected. Some people don't care very much about calories. You know, their normal weight, they feel perfectly fine. So they won't change their eating habits. But some people will be shocked by the calorie levels and choose smaller items or split a dessert with somebody, skip a dessert. We'll certainly see some changes.
That was Michael Jacobson, Executive Director of the Center for Science and the Public Interest. To learn more about the debate over food and health regulations, visit our website at btlonline.org. One day after the first anniversary on which President Obama signed his controversial health care reform bill, the Affordable Care Act, into law, Vermont's House of Representatives voted to establish the first single-payer health care system in the United States. If the state Senate adopts the single-payer bill as expected, and it's signed by Vermont's Democratic Governor Peter Shumlin, who supports the bill, all Vermonters will have access to health insurance that supporters say will contain costs. The legislation lays the groundwork to launch a statewide, publicly funded system in 4 years that will eventually marginalize most forms of private, for-profit health insurance. A panel called the Green Mountain Care Board would be allocated $1.2 million to begin developing elements of the new system. A health insurance marketplace, or exchange, would then be established to comply with the federal health care reform law. Finally, if federal waivers are secured, the exchange would be transformed into the Green Mountain Care single-payer system. Dr. Deborah Richter, president of the group Vermont for Single Payer, has campaigned for universal health care in her state since 2003. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Richter about the prospects for single-payer in Vermont and her view that if this legislation becomes law, Vermont may serve as a model for the rest of the nation, struggling to cover more citizens while controlling escalating health care costs.
Well, the goal of the overall bill, I mean, is to get to a Medicare for All type of system where essentially you'll be eligible for comprehensive health care at birth rather than waiting till you're 65. That's the overall goal. However, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know how you, it depends on how you look at it, but unfortunately we are restricted by the national bill, which doesn't allow us to apply for certain waivers that we would need to get to a pure single payer until the year 2017. And that is where our congressional delegation comes in. We're trying to get some waivers, and it may actually require legislation to override parts of the Obama bill that would allow states to do this, as long as they offered more coverage for no increase in cost. So essentially it would be Medicare for All, and if we can get the waivers, we would begin the system in 2014. So sort of this legislation is a roadmap for how to get there. We still have to work out the benefit package and the financing. And those are things that we're going to work out next year and the year after. And then we expect to, if we can get the waivers, we would then put this system in place in 2014. If not, unfortunately, we would have to comply with the national bill and not do it until 2017. So it's still a long way off, unfortunately, because of the national bill.
Dr. Richter, the health insurance companies that operate in Vermont, would they be totally put out of business if the single-payer system were established there in your state? Or how would they operate at all in the
right.
new way?
Well, they would still be allowed to provide benefits for things that would not be provided under the insurance program. And because there is an ERISA law, we would actually not be able to eliminate them, per se, by law. We could effectively eliminate what they do, but we could not eliminate them, and there would still be some self-insured employers who effectively operate like insurance companies. But in general, for the most part, insurance companies would not be providing what the plan that would serve the Medicare for All plan would be serving. So they could offer additional benefits that weren't covered under the program, the regular public program. So they would still be around for those particular benefits, but their role would be greatly reduced, and they would be used for claims processing. They could bid on the ability to do that for the state.
Reading about the history of Canada's single-payer system, it turns out that the province of Saskatchewan implemented their own single-payer system, much like Vermont would if this passes. And the success in Saskatchewan was an example to the federal government, and then they soon adopted single-payer for the entire nation of Canada. Do you see Vermont playing a similar role here in the United States, if indeed single-payer is a success in Vermont?
Absolutely. I mean, I think actually what we would end up seeing is sort of like a regional plan that we would probably get the Northeast and then eventually the rest of the country. I mean, there's no two ways about it. Single payer is a much more fiscally conservative way to cover everyone. I'm always surprised that we don't get more conservatives in favor of this, because you spend less money on health care under a single payer health care system. You spend less money on paperwork and a higher percentage on medical care, and people get broader coverage, and then that's more money to be spent in other areas of the economy. So I'm always amazed that this isn't more popular amongst people who tend to be fiscal conservatives, because it is definitely the best way to cover everybody. But I do think it'll happen, and I think it'll actually end up being not so much a moral question, but more of an economic one. And we are definitely reaching the tipping point where, when you have a high percentage of the middle class who are affected by the healthcare issue, that's when you get social change. And I really do believe that's going to happen here. I mean, I think what people need to really understand, that if you don't pay for Joe, you don't pay for the guy that was there the day before you, how can you be sure that the emergency room is going to be there for you? I mean, this is really a question of a public good more than a question of a human right. So this is not something that we can ignore. So I think it's important for us to recognize that if we want it there for us, we have to pay for everybody.
That was Dr. Deborah Richter, president of the group Vermont for Single Payer. Find more information on Vermont's single payer health care legislation on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.